We're excited to kick off this season again with Midwestern Seminary back as our flagship sponsor for the spring. Located in Kansas City, Missouri, Midwestern Seminary exists for the church by biblically educating God-called men and women to be and make disciples of Jesus Christ. Midwestern's For the Church vision permeates everything they do, from classroom experience, faculty membership, and includes their new 100% tuition scholarship for first-year residential master students through their For the Church cohorts. It's unbelievable. You have to go check this out. Even if you're unable to relocate to campus, Midwestern Seminary offers flexible and fully online undergraduate, graduate, and doctoral degrees through their global campus, which is designed to allow you to stay rooted in your current ministry context. If you're ready to begin your theological education, whether to move forward in your vocation, to be a more faithful leader in the life of your church, to be a more active and engaged disciple maker in your local context, I could not more heartily encourage you to apply to Midwestern Seminary for free with the code KNOWINGFAITH. You can apply to Midwestern Seminary for free with code KNOWINGFAITH at mbts.edu/apply. Go check out all that God is doing at Midwestern Seminary this year. You're listening to Knowing Faith, a podcast of Training the Church. This is Kyle Worland. I'm joined by my co-host, Jen Wilkin and JT English. What's up?
Hey, what could go wrong today? Nothing.
Hey guys, nothing.
Hey, it's perfect.
This is our second take to the audience. Just a peek behind the curtain here. Sometimes digital recordings freeze up, and we just had one. But we are not freezing today because it's pretty warm here in Texas, isn't it, Jen?
It is so warm. It is 90 degrees.
Yeah, it's 90 degrees. What's the temp out there in Colorado, JT?
It's like 52, 53. Wow. Pretty nice.
Brisk.
Probably going to go on a nice little walk later, you know, light jacket.
Mm-hmm. I might go for a swim.
Yeah, you never know.
Well, we are excited. I'm excited. I don't know how excited JT and Jen are. I'm excited to talk about this book today. We are, along with our series through the book of Exodus, we are taking some pauses in the season to explore some influential works of church history. Like we said in the first episode, we're not saying these are the most influential works in church history. We're saying they are influential works in church history. So if you're out there and you're pushing up the glasses on your nose saying, well, you know, you didn't mention whatever, well, you do a podcast and you do an episode about it. You know what I'm saying? These are the books we're talking about. Take it or leave it. And we're
Kyle,
doing.
I think the heat is making you a little pugnacious today.
That might be true. That might be right. Or maybe it was our pre-recording conversations. But whatever it is, yes, I am really excited about talking about Chesterton's Orthodoxy. Have you guys read this book?
Oh, I got my copy right here.
Okay, that's great.
Oh. I've got to admit, I've not read this book. Like, this is one of those books, like, you know, those movies that everybody has seen that you haven't seen and you're like, yeah, I'm not sure if I should see it. I feel kind of like that. So I'm on this podcast because I want you to convince me why I should read this book.
I have to say, the sheer number of times I am the one who has not read the book that the two of you love is just, you know, staggering compared to this one golden moment where I get to watch JT try to find his way through a conversation about a book he has not read. I hope you've taken copious notes from me, JT.
I'm just going to squirm through it. I kind of debated, should I act like I've read it before and see if I can pull it off? Yeah, he talks about orthodoxy, right?
And then did you think about standing before the judgment seat and decide maybe go another direction.
Plead the blood of Jesus. Yes. I'm not ready. I have quoted it. I've quoted it in a sermon before.
Well,
like, I was like, that's a great quote. I can use
it
that.
It is very
it's
quotable.
It's very quotable.
There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
Well, JT, since you won't be able to answer any questions about the book, I will let you ask us the questions here on the run sheet. But before that, let me ask you this question, since this is something I know you can answer. For the audience that's going, hey, you're pulling us out of a book of the Bible to talk about works that aren't the Bible. Why? What's the value of reading across church history? If somebody says to you, JT, I hear you love Bavinck and you like to read Calvin and you just did an episode recommending we read Augustine's Confessions, why would I take the precious time that I have for reading and step away from reading the Bible so that I can read church history?
Yeah, I'll make three really quick points. First is it's just good to read in community, do theology in community. That includes contemporary community. It also includes historical community that we would be reading with the brothers and sisters who are saints filled with the Holy Spirit, who lived with the Holy Spirit in them and died and tried to follow Jesus in their life. We can learn a lot from them. And there's really two things that we can learn from them. The first is we can learn that a lot of the issues that we're facing today have already been faced in church history, mm-hmm. and we can just gain a great deal of wisdom from them and their insights and their ordeals and how they dealt with those specific issues. We can also learn from their folly. Like, we can understand that's not how we should do it. Church history is not inspired history the way that the Bible is, but it's kind of like the family story. Here's where the family got things right. Here's where the family got things wrong. And lastly, I'll just say, and this is kind of a personal note for me, one of the reasons I love reading like spiritual biographies or church history is some of the issues that were huge for, let's say, Augustine, or I'm sure this will come up today in Orthodoxy or Bavinck, aren't anymore. And sometimes we can get so laser focused on what's important to us right now. And I like need the soul care in my own soul to say, this issue is going to pass the same way every issue in the past has been dealt with and talked about. And so when I read church history, I feel like I'm able to lift my eyes a little bit above our current moment. And that actually doesn't just teach me things. It actually like comforts my soul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. Mm-hmm. That is exactly right. Well, JT, what questions do you have about Chesterton and Orthodoxy?
Yes, what would you like us to tell you about the book?
How can we illuminate you, JT?
I don't know that you can put me... I almost wish I would have acted like I read it. I'm not going to be a good Kyle Worley interview question here.
You can impersonate me here. Do your best Kyle Worley
impression. All right, welcome to Knowing Faith. How are we doing, guys?
Wow. It's like looking into a mirror.
Jiu-jitsu.
Right, let's start here. I don't know who wants this one. Whoever wants this one can take it. I'm just going to toss the ball out. I don't even know a lot about G.K. Chesterton, let alone the book that we're talking about. Who was he and why is he significant?
Ooh. Yeah, so Chesterton, it's hard to describe a man like Chesterton because when you think of the phrase Renaissance man, Chesterton is like mm-hmm. that kind of a figure. Like, it is really tough to pin him down. He defied easy categorization. He wrote on Christian apologetics. He was a political thinker. He was an essayist. He was a novelist. If you've mm-hmm. ever seen, there's a BBC mm-hmm. adaptation of Father Brown, which was a character that Chesterton made up mm-hmm. and wrote books about Father Brown, who was this priest who was also a detective. It's like crazy stuff. And so if you're interested in watching that, it's actually also too like a really good adaptation of Father Brown. He wrote novels. He wrote poetry. He wrote essays.
He did what he wanted.
He wrote a bunch. But I think that the best way to summarize, if you just had to pick one word for Chesterton, I think you'd pick writer. Like, he was a writer. Mm-hmm. Now, the topics he covered, the range of interest he had in a ton of things, the genres he worked in. You know what? If I had to pick somebody that's like a contemporary analog to Chesterton, I'd probably pick somebody like a Wendell Berry. Like, Wendell Berry has written a bunch of essays. He's also written novels. He's also written poetry. Yeah, so like Wendell Berry would be maybe kind of a contemporary analog mm-hmm. to somebody like Chesterton. Chesterton was more politically informed and more of a socialite than Berry is. Yeah, I mean, G.K. Chesterton is so unique to me. I love him. You guys know this about me, but I think I respond to Chesterton because I just am like interested in everything. Like, I just like, that's why I like him so much, is because he's just like, he's interested in everything. Like, there's just like, he wants to do it all, see it all, read it all, write about everything. Like, there's nothing out there he doesn't want to put his tentacles into, so to speak. And I really appreciate him for that regard.
Well, now that we said the word tentacles, let me just read you something. It wouldn't be a podcast if tentacles didn't find their way into it. I wanted to read, this is as I was thinking about today, I read this little article about him, and it talks about all of the things that he wrote, the novels, etc., short stories and everything. And then it says, in spite of his literary accomplishments, he considered himself primarily a journalist. He wrote over 4,000 newspaper essays, including 30 years worth of weekly columns for the Illustrated London News and 13 years of weekly columns for the Daily News. He also edited his own newspaper, as one does. And so he says, to put it into perspective, 4,000 essays is the equivalent of writing an essay a day, every day, for 11 years.
Wow.
So he was prolific.
That's a ton. Like, I can't even, when I hear things like that, it just blows my mind.
Mm-hmm. It is crazy. Like, it is absolutely crazy just how prolific he was, and also influential. Like, here's a couple of data points, and I'm pulling these right out of, you could pull these off of Wikipedia, I'm sure. These are actually in Trevin Wax's annotations and introduction for his copy of Orthodoxy, which is really good. This is a fantastic edition of Orthodoxy. Trevin did a great job with it. But just a couple of little data points here. When you think about influential people who then looked at Chesterton as somebody of great influence, Gandhi translated one of Chesterton's essays. So, like, Gandhi, you think of it like Gandhi as maybe one of the most significant political figures of the 19th and 20th mm-hmm. century. It's like, you know what? I should probably translate this so that people can read it in our language as well. T.S. Eliot, one of the most influential and significant poets mm-hmm. of the last 300 years, says, if I were to state his essential quality, I would say that it is a sort of triumphant common sense, a joyous acclaim towards the splendor and powers of the soul. H.L. Mm-hmm. Mencken, who was also a journalist and a newspaper guy, like a writer, Mencken was a strong opponent against Christianity and avowed atheist. This is what he says of the work Orthodoxy. He says, Orthodoxy is the best argument for Christianity I have ever read. And now I have gone through, I suppose, fully 100. So he's basically looking at this book and be like, I'm not a Christian, but the most convincing argument I ever read as an atheist was Chesterton's work, Orthodoxy. So, like, these are heavyweights of both mm-hmm. Chesterton's peers and those who received his work. He had an incredible influence over C.S. Lewis. He had an incredible influence over Tolkien. Like, the figures that we've come to understand as really significant heavyweights, Chesterton had a significant influence on them.
That's awesome.
I figured that was the reason that Kyle loves it is because of chapter 4 of Orthodoxy. Is that what you is that what brought you to it originally? Is it because you love C.S. Lewis?
Yes, basically. Was chapter 4 is what got me in the door. Actually, I think that the first time I read Orthodoxy, I read a selection of it. It was a printed like bundle of pages that my philosophy uh-huh. professor at DBU gave me, and it was chapter 4. That was my first access point to the book.
Hmm. Yeah, chapter 4 is called The Ethics of Elfland. And so he basically does this exercise where he talks about fantasy and how it helps us to understand the world.
Yep.
Jen, what brought you to Orthodoxy? Do you remember the first time you read it? Why do you keep reading it?
Well, I want to be honest, I haven't kept reading it. I probably read it twice, and it's been a while since the last time I read it. Like, I was going back through, based on my annotations, I read it twice because there's two different pens in here, and that's how I know. I always use a different colored pen the second time through. I read this for the first time around the same time that I would have read Confessions. I was trying to tick off the, I was trying to be self-educated as best as I could to be a better Bible teacher in the local church. And so I read this around the time that I read Augustine's Confessions because it was one of the names that just kept coming up and coming up. And in this case, I did have a good friend who had read it and she recommended it to me. But you know, I grew up on Tolkien and Lewis too. So I was intrigued to hear the voice that had impacted them as well. So I can't really call Kyle out as an outlier. I think that's probably why a lot of people mm-hmm. in our generation, that's the same reason I read Dorothy Sayers too, because I wanted to see, I wanted to hear another voice who was a part of that whole sort of sphere of writers.
Kyle, what about you? I mean, you said it was chapter 4, but like, I also know that you've said you've read it a lot. Like, when I read books multiple times and keep coming back to it, it's like with new lenses and I see different things. Has that been your experience with Orthodoxy? It's like, man, I didn't even see that the first time.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think I'd go as far to say that outside of the Bible, Lord of the Rings, Calvin's Institute, there's not
big words.
Yeah. The Bible, Lord of the Rings, Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion. I would say that Orthodoxy has the most influence over me of any other book, without question. And
really?
Yeah. And I read it a lot and I come back to it a lot. I'm always aspiring to see the world the way that Chesterton communicates the world back to me in Orthodoxy. And everything in our world opposes my participation in the world in the way that Chesterton lays out. And I think that's why I have to keep coming back to it. You know, the book is really a response. Orthodoxy is a response. That's why it exists. It exists because Chesterton had been significantly and seriously in every medium available to him, critiquing other available life views, worldviews, philosophies, what we've called here false stories. and he had been ripping them to shreds. He's a very incisive thinker, and he would take up a life view, a worldview, and he would say, okay, so you're a nihilist. Well, guess what? Let me absolutely destroy nihilism as a coherent worldview. Okay, so you're an Eastern thinker. Okay, let me turn that on its head. Okay, so you think that political utopianism is the goal? Guess what? Here's a few reflections on exactly why it's not going to work out. So he'd been doing this over and over again. And then he was publicly challenged to go, hey, you're critiquing all these other philosophies. You need to state your philosophy of life. That's what orthodoxy is. Orthodoxy is Chesterton responding to a public challenge. Think about this as like a, you know, a New York Times commentator telling somebody on the Washington Post who's, you know, writing columns every week, dispelling maybe the most dominant stories being put forward by the New York Times, and the op-ed team coming out and saying, hey, okay, we understand that you have very serious critiques of what we're putting forward. Why don't you put your cards on the table? That's what orthodoxy is. It's him responding to a public challenge to put his worldview, his story, his narrative, his philosophy of life on full view and to allow criticism to be made of it. That's what orthodoxy is. It's that response. And every time I come back to it, I'm challenged of how small a Christian life view I have accepted and I have settled for. Because what Chesterton puts forward in a really a short amount of pages, like it's not, it is not a really long book. I mean, most editions are going to be somewhere between 150 and 250 pages. You can read this.
Isn't it amazing that some of the best books ever written in Christianity are short?
Yeah.
That's amazing. I didn't realize it was indictment. That short.
Yeah, it really is. You can think about this. You can think about Lewis's Four Loves, just the ability to do a ton.
On the Incarnation. On the Incarnation. The books we're talking about are short books.
Yeah, so Chesterton is able to do this in such a compelling way that, you know, well over 100 years later, we're picking this book up. We're reading it. We're reflecting on it. So
that's awesome. Jen, back to you. I want to ask you, like, if you were to maybe, let's say you're handing this to me or you're handing this to a friend at church or something like that. What's one thing you would hope stands out to the person who's reading it? Like, you know, Kyle, they're talking about giving you this bigger life view and understanding and accepting kind of his understanding of the world. What's either your biggest takeaway or a takeaway that you think a reader really should look for?
Well, okay, I'm going to give two answers. One was, first of all, it's going to challenge your thinking. It's going to, I think it's like he had, one of the things that sticks out in my mind was he has this approach to where he talks about pessimism. And he, I think he refers to it as like a great blasphemy or something like that. Wow. And so he's extremely quotable, which is going to lead to my next point. But by thinking about pessimism as not just a sin, but as a great blasphemy. He's able to use hyperbole in ways that really clarify sort of the thing. I would call them the sins of this age, but apparently they were the sins of his age as well. And to where you realize, oh, for me to call myself a Christian, it's not just a partial opting out. It's a whole different way of thinking about the way that people speak and think and act. But then the second reason I would say to read it is because he's such a good writer. And he's going to make you better at expressing your own views. Like if you have ever wondered how people get to be good writers, I'm convinced it's because they read good writing a lot. And in fact, I remember the first time that I read this, there's one part where he's taking on a lot of his contemporary voices of his day. And at one point he takes a jab at Oscar Wilde. I am a huge Oscar Wilde fan because he was so quick with his wit and so good at a turn of phrase. And when he takes him on, he basically uses his own weapons against him, his own weapons of language against him. And I realized, oh, this is a person who can go toe to toe, you know, from a literary standpoint with someone like Oscar Wilde. And yet different from Oscar Wilde, this is someone who holds my worldview and is telling me how to hold it better. So, and again, I love Oscar Wilde. So if you are a lover of words, but even if you're not, I think you'll find it accessible. But if you're a lover of words, this is an absolute treat from start to finish.
How can Christians wholeheartedly pursue God without an undercurrent of guilt, fear, or anxiety? How can imperfect people experience God's peace while seeking to obey His perfect standards? Faith Chang writes to fellow Christian perfectionists in her new book, Peace Over Perfection. Discover the depths of God's patience, mercy, and righteousness, and find freedom to pursue Him with peace. Listeners get 25% off at thegoodbook.com with code KNOWING. That's Peace Over Perfection by Faith Chang. You can find it at thegoodbook.com and get 25% off with the code KNOWING. Meet your new favorite study companion. Immerse yourself in both the Old and New Testaments with the Holman Handbooks, brought to you by the Christian Standard Bible. I've got to tell you, I love these handbooks. They contain charts, maps, word studies, and more for each book of the Bible. They are some of my most used resources whenever I'm studying a passage. They intersect beauty, goodness, and truth, and they're designed to last a lifetime as a valuable resource for Bible study, teaching, and ongoing discipleship. They're available in two different cover options for each. Buy one, get one free at lifeway.com with the promo code HandbookBogo. Again, that is HandbookBogo on lifeway.com in order to get some of these Holman handbooks. HandbookBogo, Handbook BOGO on lifeway.com for these Holman handbooks. They are fantastic resources. If I could, if you guys will allow me, I want to read
just
a portion of it because it's and this is early on in the book, and selfishly, I would really love to co-opt this episode and just make it 7 hours long and read this entire book out loud, and then you could just have it. Then you'd have it. I'm sure that copyright people would come after me. This book is fantastic. Let me read this portion of it because the way he plays with words to make a point, it's self-deprecating. It reveals truth. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable. He says,
he's super funny.
Oh, he is. If this book is a joke, it is a joke against me. I am the man who with the utmost daring discovered what had been discovered before. If there's an element of farce in what follows, the farce is at my own expense. For this book explains how I fancied I was the first to set foot in Brighton, and then I found I was the last. It recounts my elephantine adventures in pursuit of the obvious. No one can think my case more ludicrous than I think it myself. No reader can accuse me here of trying to make a fool of him. I am the fool of the story, and no rebel shall hurl me from my throne. I freely confess all the idiotic ambitions of the end of the 19th century. I did, like all other solemn little boys, try to be in advance of the age. Like them, I tried to be some 10 minutes in advance of the truth, and I found that I was 1,800 years behind it. I did strain my voice with a painfully juvenile exaggeration in uttering my truths, and I was punished in the fittest and funniest way. For I have kept my truths, but I have discovered not that they were not truths, but simply that they were not mine. When I fancied that I stood alone, I was really in the ridiculous position of being backed up by all Christendom. It may be, heaven forgive me, that I did try to be original, but I only succeeded in inventing all by myself an inferior copy of the existing traditions of civilized religion. The man from the yacht thought he was the first to find England. I thought I was the first to find Europe. I did try to found and start a new heresy of my own. And when I'd put the last touches to it, I discovered that it was Christian orthodoxy. It's unbelievable. Like, I could read this. I'm tearing up. I love this book so much. It makes me want to cry. Like, this is like whenever you have a bite of like that food that you've been craving for so long and it brings tears to your eye. Every time I just read this book a month ago, I could start right now and read this again. This is one of those books that when I finish the last page, I think, I want to start over and reread the whole thing. I love this book so, so, so much.
Now, I assume you guys wouldn't recommend anybody that isn't just like thoroughly in the Protestant, Reformed, you know, maybe Baptistic tradition, yeah. Right? Tell me about his like theological views and specifically his relationship with the church.
Go ahead, Kyle.
Yeah. Well, he's a Catholic and he's pretty proud of his Catholicism. He's not a big fan of Calvin. Calvin does not get a favorable view in Chesterton's writings broadly. I think he does mention Calvin at least twice in Orthodoxy. Both times he is not a fan of Calvin or Calvinism or Reformed theological movement. He starts off in the Church of England as a young boy, like most young boys in England do. He becomes a Catholic a little bit later in life, and then he's a faithful Catholic for the rest of his life and a proud Catholic. I mean, this guy is happy to be a Catholic. Mm-hmm. Okay. And mm-hmm. So if you come to this book expecting him to not be Catholic, it's just not going to happen. He is so
to be non-Catholic.
He is so obviously proud of his Catholicism. He wants you to be Catholic too. Mm. And here's where I have to say, I'm not, I'm not at, like, I think this has come out in the episodes, but actually we recorded an episode earlier this season and somebody on Twitter, I think, was being a little snarky about
what on Twitter. Someone was snarky that.
And they were like, I can't believe you guys don't talk about the, you know, how this document or whatever was written in the Catholic Church. Yeah, it was. I mean, so what? The question is whether
a lot of them were.
Yeah, the question is whether it's true. You know, the provenance of a thing is one question, but it's one question. The question is its veracity, its goodness, its beauty. And on that measurement, Orthodoxy stands strongly on two feet. It is a very strong Christian accounting of the world. Chesterton's Catholic imagination is a benefit to us. The Catholic imagination is a benefit to us because Catholicism, and you can have your quibbles with Rome, I certainly do, but Catholicism has been,
I hope so,
a consistent antagonist towards hypermodernity and all of on all of its little preferences and whims. Part of, and this gets back to Orthodoxy, Chesterton takes modernity to task in a way that is very helpful for us. You and I don't live in a postmodern world. We live in a hypermodern world. And so I know that maybe for some, you've been told that this is a postmodern moment, that this is postmodernity. That's fine as long as you understand that to mean that modernity hasn't been left behind. Modernity has been turned up so loud that now some people view its conclusions as ridiculous, and other people view its conclusions as religion. Okay. So okay, that's like,
define modernity though.
Modernity is an acceleration of believing the human is at the center of the story, that man is the measurement of all that claims to be true, good, and beautiful, and that the best way that we can explore the true, good, and beautiful is with man at the center and man is the measurement. That's modernity.
Okay. Now, and so hypermodernity, therefore, would be...
It accelerates that to the nth degree, which either turns it into law or it turns it into ridiculousness. Postmoderns who go, oh, there is no such thing as truth, they're not... They are hypermodern. They're hypermodern in the sense that they've gone, the conclusions of modernity are so ridiculous as we should now just mock them and be skeptical of them. Whereas maybe somebody that's more of a naturalist... Or some forms of secularism take the conclusions of hypermodernity to be so true that they treat them as articles of faith, or almost there's a religious sensibility, like science. When somebody's like, well, I just believe in science, that's not a postmodern person. That's a hypermodern person who has taken something that they received by faith and they now just go ahead and assume its cogency, its coherence, its truthfulness, its world explaining abilities without actually having to do any investigation of their own. So hypermodernity is a time in which modernity's conclusions that man is at the center and man is the measuring stick either get ridiculed and their skepticism about that, any kind of truth claim, or they turn into a religion of their own. And Chesterton takes that to task in a way that only a Catholic can. And I mean that. The Catholics are really, really, really good at this because they have never bought in confessionally to the divide between the sacred and the secular. They haven't done it. They're articulating a world that has holes poked in the natural order. It's a super naturally charged world. This is a lot of Charles Taylor's work in A Secular Age, which is a much larger book that many of you won't have any interest in reading, but is a highly influential work, maybe one of the most influential works of philosophy in the last 50 years. And many books have been written about it. But the point is, Chesterton fully believes the world is enchanted. It's not just a natural thing. It's a merging of a natural and supernatural order that's happening. Because of that, he looks at modernity and he shows modernity itself in the mirror and goes, you're actually a lie unto yourself and your conclusions are false. For that reason, I'm happy that he's a Catholic, you know? I probably would disagree with him on a number of issues. Probably disagree with me. And I have no doubt he'd win those arguments by powers of persuasion because he's far more persuasive than I am. He is a Catholic.
All right, let's see if you can be persuasive here. So I just went to trainingthechurch.com, clicked on resources, and Orthodoxy pops up as a resource to buy from 10 of those. Mm-hmm. I'm almost there. convince me to buy it. You each have 5 seconds. Not 5 seconds. As long as you want. But not as long as you want. Like short answer, you know.
Jen,
like,
you got to start him.
Mine would be if you're someone who has, if you're a content generator, like if you teach or preach or write, this will be something that is going to bring alive a lot of thinking in you, whether out of agreement or disagreement. And so it would therefore be a fruitful read. And you are one of those people, JT.
I guess I should buy it.
There we go.
Kyle?
I'll read a portion of it to you. And if this isn't enough to convince you, then I don't think I can. This is what he says about modernity. The modern world is full of the old Christian virtues gone mad. The virtues have gone mad because they've been isolated from each other and are wandering alone. In short, the modern revolutionary, being an infinite skeptic, is always engaging and undermining his own minds. In his book on politics, he attacks men for trampling on morality. In his book on ethics, he attacks morality for trampling on men. Therefore, the modern man in revolt has become practically useless for all purposes of revolt. By rebelling against everything, he has lost his right to rebel against anything. That, to me, is, I mean, in seven
that
sentences,
really
maybe
good.
The best criticism of the modern man and the modern mind that you could possibly have. And this is, I mean, this book is timeless. There are books that are like this. Confessions is like this. Pilgrim's Progress, I think, is like this. Orthodoxy is like this. Alan Bloom's The Closing of the American Mind is like this. These are books that just, they hold up. And it feels like every year, Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death. Go read Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death before you realize when it was written. And it will stagger you how prophetic he was. Orthodoxy, just every year, it's like, well, it's more true than it was last year, unfortunately.
It's really good. Okay, I'm going to buy it.
Mm. You should. When you read it, let me know. And then, you know.
We can have a book club.
We should have a book club. Aren't we doing this for the book club?
We're not doing this book for the book club, but if you're interested in the Knowing Faith book club, you can go to trainthechurch.com/support. JT and I are talking about Jeremy Treat's The Crucified King this week. So thank you for that softball there, JT. If you want to talk about The Crucified King with us, then trainthechurch.com/support.
Kyle, that's all I got. I'm done asking questions.
You did great, man. Man,
you did so great.
You
maybe honestly, you can be the new glue.
Yeah, you should.
The new glue for Knowing Faith. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great,
man.
We
should take turns.
We're just going to start calling you Elmer.
Is it this easy?
If you want to find Knowing Faith, yeah. You just make it look easy, brother. That's how good you are. You're a natural.
Oh, there it is. There it is.
If you want to find Knowing Faith, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Just don't be snarky after you find us. We want to thank you for listening to the show today. Don't forget to check out our sponsors through our webpage link in the show notes. If you heard us run an ad or something like that, we do vet those things. We believe in those things. You can check out any of those sponsors over at trainthechurch.com under the Knowing Faith webpage, or you can click on the show notes wherever you're listening to your podcast, and you can find the information there. If you want to grab a copy of Orthodoxy, go to tenofthose.com/knowingfaith. They've been kind enough to set up a little bookstore for us there where you can get copies of the books we're talking about along with every book we've ever recommended on the show, which is pretty cool. And they do have my preferred version of Orthodoxy. This is by B&H Academic, and Trevin Wax did the annotations and some commentary on it. It is really, really helpful. If you're a new reader to this, this book can feel like he's referencing some people and places that you're not familiar with. You know, he's in the early 20th century in London. You're not probably in the early 20th century in London. So you might need some
probably.
Help. And Trevin can help you with that. If you're interested in discussing books with us, you can go over. We're reading in February. We did The Crucified King with Jeremy Treat. In March, I'm doing a David Brooks book with Jen, which will be fun. How to Know a Person. And then in April, we're doing an early cut of the introduction in chapter one of my forthcoming book, Home with God. And that one we're going to do live so that I can field your questions and get your feedback. And then maybe the book gets better on the other side of discussing it with you. Hopefully. But we really enjoy having you listen to the show. We also have some great sister shows you should check out. If you've got kids under the age of 12 and you want to teach them doctrine in a compelling and persuasive format, check out Tiny Theologians. They're doing incredible work teaching the big doctrines of God, who he is and his character and nature over at the Tiny Theologians podcast. And if you're a parent or you work with kiddos or students and you want to be engaged in thinking through how you can be an active discipler of them, go check out the fine folks over at the Family Discipleship podcast. We love what they're doing. We hope you enjoy the discussion today. Grace and peace. Did this episode spark an interest to learn more about Jesus, the Bible, or theology? You can receive free theological training through Midwestern Seminary's For the Church Institute, which offers courses in Old and New Testament, Christian theology, and more, including the newly released course on missional leadership. Again, this is free theological training that you can use for your own equipping, for the equipping of those in your church, and it is available for groups or on your own. You can learn more and get started today at FTCInstitute.com. Again, that's FTCInstitute.com for theological training courses, free theological training courses today. Go check it out.